The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick, and thanks for being here this Sunday night. A case could be made, a very good case, that the most beloved and respected charitable organization in this country is St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And tonight, you'll learn some of the reasons why from Rick Shadyac, the president and CEO of St. Jude's fundraising and awareness arm, ALSAC, and the progress that has been made since the hospital first opened is nothing less than remarkable.
So, yeah, in 1962, when we opened our doors, the survival rate for the most common form of childhood cancer, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, was 4%. Mm-hmm. And then today, due in large part to the work done here at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, that survival rate is now 94%.
Wow.
Yeah, great progress. And we've been instrumental in taking the overall childhood cancer survival rates from 20% when we opened our doors in 1962 to 80% today.
And then it will be joined by Phil Buchanan, the CEO of the Center for Effective Philanthropy and the author of a book that will be coming out this Tuesday titled Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. He'll tell us why he wrote this book and why now.
And I think it's an untold story, actually, in some ways, how crucial giving and the nonprofit sector is to what makes this country strong. And I've also witnessed donors make the same mistakes, predictable mistakes. And my hope is that the book helps people avoid some of the common pitfalls.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, April 14th. For the first time in history, atheists constitute the largest religious group in America. According to the General Social Survey, the number of Americans who have no religion has increased 266% over the past three decades and now account for 23.1% of the population, just barely edging out Catholics and evangelicals as the nation's dominant faith. Ride-hailing company Lyft has announced plans to invest $50 million annually, or 1% of its profits, whichever is greater, in transportation and community improvement initiatives in cities where it operates. It will be called Lyft City Works. The Tufts University School of Medicine has announced that it received donated land valued at $10.8 million. Plan is to sell the land to launch a center that will study excessive pathological selfishness, with the goal of figuring out what creates extreme self-centeredness. And finally, the top Republican and Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee urged the IRS to investigate whether payments that parents made to a sham charity involved in the college admission scandal were improperly claimed as tax-deductible donations. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday night. I'll be back to speak with Rick Shadyac of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Learn more by visiting benetech.org.
Welcome back to the Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
According to a recent survey, the nonprofit that had the greatest brand awareness among households earning more than $100,000 was St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And the charity that had the greatest awareness with households making less than $100,000 was St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. So I guess I could say that my next guest needs little introduction. He is Rick Shadyac, the president of St. Jude's fundraising and awareness arm, ALSAC. Good evening, Rick, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver. It's a privilege to be here with you.
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital was founded by comedian, entertainer, and TV star Danny Thomas. Tell our listeners about him and what inspired him to start this organization.
So Danny Thomas, I think, was one of the most visionary leaders of my lifetime, that's for sure. You know, the story is beautiful and compelling. Danny was a struggling actor back in the 1930s, and he was down on his luck, and he went into a church and prayed to St. Jude Thaddeus, who's the patron saint of hopeless cases in the Catholic religion, and he was Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
His wife was pregnant with what would turn out to be Marlo Thomas, and walked into that church and said, St. Jude, help me find my way in life, and I'll build you a shrine. And, you know, really what he was saying, Denver, is help me figure out whether or not I should get a real job or pursue my passion
yes.
as an entertainer. He just didn't have enough money. He didn't have health insurance, and he didn't have enough money to pay the bill for his wife to get out of the hospital and to deliver the baby. And St. Jude answered his prayer. He got a job the next day as a singing toothbrush on the radio,
mm-hmm.
and he got enough money to pay the bill for the hospital, and you know, kind of the rest is history, except that unlike a lot of folks that make those kinds of prayers, he remembered the promise and the prayer that he made to St. Jude, and ultimately that promise evolved to the point where he wanted to build a hospital that would treat catastrophically ill kids. He would treat them without regard to race, creed, religion, or ability to pay. The first disease he was counseled to tackle was leukemia, which was deemed incurable in the early 60s and 50s as this was being formulated, a 4% survival rate. And then ultimately, he was counseled to put it in a city where kids didn't necessarily have access to quality specialty health care. And he ultimately decided to do this to say thank you to God and the United States of America for giving his parents, my grandparents, the opportunity to come to this country and to make a life. So he was honoring his heritage and paying tribute to our great country.
Yeah, that really is a lovely founding story. And you talk about St. Jude. I mean, leukemia back in those days was almost a hopeless cause with a 4% survival rate, as you say. In fact, I think kids were celebrating half birthdays. It was that severe because they were afraid they weren't going to make it to their next birthday. What's the survival rate of leukemia today among children? And also, how has the cure rate for childhood cancer changed over that period of time?
So, yeah, in 1962, when we opened our doors, the survival rate for the most common form of childhood cancer, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, was 4%.
Mm-hmm.
And then today, due in large part to the work done here at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, that survival rate is now 94%.
Wow.
Yeah, great progress. And we've been instrumental in taking the overall childhood cancer survival rates from 20% when we opened our doors in 1962 to 80% today, and we're not going to stop until no child dies from cancer, because still in the United States, 1 in 5 children will pass away from childhood cancer, and it remains the leading cause of death by disease in U.S. kids today. So St. Jude still has its work to do, and I hope at some point in our interview today that we can talk about global statistics, because they are incredibly dire.
Yeah, I know they are. How do patients find you, Rick? Who is eligible, and what is the nature of the relationship between the hospital and the family?
Well, ideally, patients are referred here by their pediatrician or local pediatric oncologist. You have to have since we're a specialty hospital, you have to have a disease that we treat.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it's cancer or a disease of the blood, things like that.
Yep.
And then ideally, you're eligible for one of our research protocols. So we are a research hospital. Our name is intentional. We're not St. Jude Children's Hospital. We're St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. So we are not only treating kids, you know, with the highest caliber medical care, but also we're desperately searching for cures and improved therapies for these kids. So those are the major criteria. And then you have to think about some of this is a self-selection process because, you know, our protocols can last 2 and 3 years.
Yeah.
So it's a substantial time commitment, especially if you're coming from one of the coasts and things like that. The kids that end up coming here are some of the sickest kids in the United States and in the world because we have the highest survival rates for some of the most challenging cancers.
Yeah, and you don't turn away anybody who doesn't have the ability to pay.
That's correct. Well, no family will ever receive a bill from St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, not for the cost of treatment, travel, housing, or food, because all we want mom and dad to worry about is helping their child survive cancer.
Yeah, and you have a very well-earned reputation for compassion, because I can imagine what a very frightening time this must be for the entire family and for these children who are seeing doctors and needles and this equipment and medicine for the very first time. How does the hospital help allay those fears among those young people?
You know, look, I think that we see families when they're at some of their lowest points, okay? Mm-hmm. And I've heard many of these moms talk to me, and you know, I heard one last week that just told us that you know, she had just gotten the word that her child had cancer, and it broke her heart. Okay. And then all of the hopes and dreams that she had for her child, you know, she had to put on hold. But then you come to St. Jude, and then people will always describe to me, it feels like they've been given a big hug, and it feels like they instantly have hope. It's a spirit that's here. You know, even though we're dealing with catastrophic illness, this is a place of hope. This is a place where kids can still be kids, even though they're going through some of the most difficult trials. And, you know, we believe here that when a child has cancer, the entire family has cancer.
Oh, yeah.
And we are all about family-centered care. And we want to give these kids and the moms and dads and their siblings the best environment that we can in order to help them battle childhood cancer. And attitude is so important. And that's where the public comes in, because the public support is what allows us to create this very, very unique environment and do exactly what we need to do, take the necessary steps, regardless of financial circumstances or how good a person's health insurance is, to make sure that child, every child, has the same opportunity to survive that catastrophic disease.
I was looking at your most recent strategic plan, and I noted that one of your objectives is to recruit more patients. What's the thinking behind that, and how are you going to go about trying to achieve that objective?
Well, we want to impact as many patients as we possibly can, okay, because we believe that we give the highest quality of care here. But also fundamentally, you know, we are, as I said, a research mm-hmm. hospital, so we're creating these clinical protocols, and we need to enroll a certain number of kids on all of these protocols to test the efficacy of these protocols. So the more kids that we can get here, the faster we can test those clinical trials to see whether or not they're actually going to advance cures, have less toxicity, reduce side effects, have better long-term prognoses for these kids. So that's the rationale behind this. But again, because of the support of the public, we've been able to materially expand our mission, as we are on a multi-billion dollar expansion of our mission as you and I have this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're absolutely right also about how research sometimes gets overlooked. I think we get all so consumed by the child and the cancer, but I don't think many people appreciate that you're actually a granting institution where people are receiving PhDs in biomedical sciences and things of that sort. And along those lines, you have plans for a big new building, which is going to be going up in 2021 around research. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we are granting. So we have a PhD program, and now we've just started our master's program in global health as well. So we're excited about that. So we do believe that it's our obligation to train the next generation of doctors and scientists here in an effort to try to improve global health outcomes. And also, again, because about 50% of our resources, which come from the public, actually are dedicated to research and finding cures, we are building a brand new state-of-the-art $412 million research tower that is springing out of the ground. As I look out my window here, I see two stories already built. And you know, it's very exciting for us because we hope and pray that that building will house the labs that will lead to discoveries for more and more kids surviving and less kids having these, you know, really still tough side effects from the current therapies that are on the market.
Well, as you said before, when Danny Thomas founded St. Jude's, he said no child should die in the dawn of life. He didn't say no child in the United States. It was more of a universal expression. And to that end, you have partnered with the World Health Organization and have done a whole bunch of other things around St. Jude Global. Tell us about that and give us some of those statistics, if you would.
Sure, I'd be happy to, Denver. So to me, this is the next frontier. And I know Dr. Downing, the CEO of St. Jude, feels the exact same way. We've made remarkable progress in the United States, and we have an 80% survival rate, still not good enough. Mm-hmm. As you and I discussed before, it remains the leading cause of death by disease in U.S. kids today. But around the globe, over 400,000 new cases of cancer are going to be diagnosed, 400,000 in kids ages, you know, from a baby to 14 years old. Mm. 43% of the children who develop cancer around the world are never even diagnosed. And it's 1962 all over again, Denver. That's the message. 4 in 5 kids in low and middle income countries around the world are going to pass away, and pass away relatively quickly. So 80% survive in the United States, 80% pass away around the globe. We seek to change that. We partnered with the WHO. We made an initial $15 million commitment to them as part of our well over $100 million commitment to advance the survival rates around the world. And our St. Jude CEO went to the United Nations and proudly proclaimed that we seek to raise the overall childhood cancer survival rates for the 6 most common forms of childhood cancer to 60%, not 50 years from now, but by 2030, in 11 years from now. And we think we can do this because we know that we have a problem that we have partially solved here in the United States, and we believe it's our moral obligation to take what we've learned here and transport that around the globe. What we know, Denver, is that right now, where a child lives is the single biggest determinant of their health care outcome. We think that's completely unjust. We think this is completely consistent with our mission that we try to take care of those kids as well, since we've done such a great job of taking care of the kids here in the United States.
Yeah, that's so wonderful to hear. And, you know, I don't think there is enough nonprofit organizations that really grab on to those bold and audacious visions, the way that you've just described, which can really galvanize and inspire an entire community.
Well, I just go right back to our founder. I think our founder had one of the most bold and ambitious and audacious visions on the planet. So, you know, now it's our turn.
Absolutely.
It's our generation, and it's our turn to have those kind of same bold, visionary, audacious plans, because if you don't dream it, it's not going to happen.
Well, so much of the work you do is supported by this fundraising enterprise that you oversee. I mean, it's a billion-dollar-plus operation, and the lion's share is coming from philanthropic support. And the lion's share of that is really coming from relatively modest gifts from the people across the country. I mean, you have 1 million volunteers, 11 million-plus donors, an average gift of $43. Tell us a little bit about that and how you've seen direct response evolve maybe in the last 5 or 10 years, and what seems to be working exceptionally well for St. Jude.
Look, I think the fundamental way that we're successful is the beauty and purity of our mission.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody that can say what we say. I mean, I think everybody can relate to helping a child, especially a child that's dealt with a catastrophic disease. I think that people find some beauty and comfort in the idea that we're taking the economics completely out of the equation when a family comes here, and that we're going to do whatever it takes to get their child better. I think we can all kind of, put ourselves in that position. And if we're blessed to have healthy kids, we should be giving thanks for those healthy kids and then giving for those who may not be as fortunate as those of us who have been blessed to have kids with great health. And the general public has absolutely embraced it. You recited our statistics absolutely accurately. We are Middle America's charity, and you know, we know that it takes a whole array of people to be able to support this mission, because the hospital budget itself is going to be more than $1 billion
mm-hmm.
this year, and it's an ever-expanding hospital budget, as you've referenced, in terms of the additional patients that we're seeing and the capital projects that we have going on. So, I mean, there's a lot there that makes up our mission, and we are also blessed to have 1 million volunteers that allow us to execute about 31,000 fundraising events all across the country, and corporate America has also embraced us. So it's really everybody in the United States and increasingly around the world that has said, we want to support St. Jude Children's Research Hospital because we believe in what they stand for.
Yeah, one of your corporate partners that has recently embraced you that I saw in the news was Best Buy, correct?
Well, Best Buy is a fabulous corporate partner. It's our single biggest corporate partner, and you know, proud to tell you that they raised almost $20.8 million during their most recent Thanksgiving campaign for us, which is our holiday campaign,
mm-hmm.
and that was an absolute record for them.
Yeah, and to what you said before, you know, most organizations I talk to have about 31,000 donors. As you said, you have 31,000 events. That's like 100 events a day. Tell us about those volunteers and give us an example of a couple of those events, like the Math-a-thon. I love your Math-a-thon.
Yeah, we try to devise programs that appeal to audiences, through your entire life spectrum. So, we have a trekathon program that's a preschool mm-hmm. program that's centered around bike safety. We have math-a-thon programs that are centered around, elementary school kids solving math problems. We go all the way through the life cycle. We've done very, very well with college kids. College kids love our mission. The single biggest commitment that's ever been made to this institution was made by Tri Delta, which is a sorority. And these women are amazing. They made a $60 million commitment to name one of our housing facilities here. I could go on and on. But then, you get into, as people get older, we have all sorts of fitness events. We're prolific in endurance kind of races and walks. We have our St. Jude Memphis Marathon, mm-hmm. which is our single biggest fundraiser, where we'll raise north of $11 million on a single day. But these are 25,000 people that come together to support our marathon and half marathon, and they raise money as heroes. We're blessed to have the support of the country music industry that's raised almost $1 billion to support our life-saving mission through radiothons and things like that. And then, we have your classic kind of golf tournaments and galas. I just came back from the Patrick Warburton Celebrity Golf Tournament, where we raised $2.2 million to see the Hollywood community coming together, especially since our founder reached out to the Hollywood community initially, mm-hmm. along with members of the Lebanese and Syrian community. And then, our multicultural efforts are absolutely critical to our success as well. We like to think of ourselves as being the charity of choice among Hispanics and African Americans, and those communities are so generous in their support of St. Jude, and we're blessed to have them as part of our very, very diverse family.
And no matter what your age or your community, everybody loves your This T-Shirt Saves Lives T-Shirt, don't they?
Yeah, I kind of challenged the team. I said, we have these pretty traditional shirts here, and I said, I've got to come up with something cool. And they came up with something incredibly cool. And again, the public loves it. All you need to do is become a partner in Hope, $19 a month, and you can get this T-shirt. And I'll tell you what, you wear it, people will stop you on the street because it says this shirt saves lives, and they want to know the story, and you tell the story to them, and then all of a sudden they want to get one of those shirts and become part of the St. Jude family. So, it's raised a lot of money for us. It's created tremendous awareness for us, and it's very, very cool.
It really is cool. It's great to have a T-shirt that can become a conversation piece like that. St. Jude is always pushing to innovate, too, and if I recall correctly, you started the Pediatric Cancer Genome Project in 2009, which is right at the height of the recession. So innovation never takes a holiday at St. Jude. What do you do to have a corporate culture that is so innovative?
Well, you're right about the Pediatric Cancer Genome Project, and I'm very, very proud that our board had enough confidence in ALSAC to raise the money to conduct the largest study of the pediatric cancer genome, literally in the history of genomics. And that's actually morphed into a larger study now. We are trying desperately to find the causes of childhood cancer because mm-hmm. we know that the way kids get cancer is completely different than the way adults get cancer because they haven't made unhealthy lifestyle decisions and been affected by environmental factors and things like that. So I'm proud that our board made an initial $65 million investment in the Pediatric Cancer Genome Project during the Great Recession, and I'm proud that our organization was able to ultimately fund that initiative. And it's gone on to cost lots more money than that. But it's in our DNA. We seek to find cures here. So we're going to do things that no one else can do. Dr. Downing has a saying, if not St. Jude, then who?
Yeah.
So I think that's in our DNA. And even over here on the fundraising side, we're keenly interested in innovation. We've been on a digital transformation of our organization as the fundraising organization now for several years. And we've made, substantial, conservative but substantial investments in technology to advance our digital transformation, trying to meet people where they are. And this is exactly why we've been able to grow and grow at a greater pace from a revenue perspective than a lot of our sister charities, because we have chosen to make these investments and we're very, very thoughtful about the things that we choose to invest in. But we know that we need to meet our supporters where they are. And some of the traditional methods of fundraising, while we'll continue to do them, they become less and less important as we kind of march forward with technology in the age that we're in.
Yeah, one of the things you've done with technology has been voice activation contributions through devices such as Alexa. How would you rate that? How's that been working?
You know, it's in its infancy, in all honesty, and I think, you know, you have to wait to see whether or not people gravitate to that. We did a test pilot with Amazon, mm-hmm. and it went well. You know, we don't get a lot of money through that method, but what it does is, it shows you that we have an ability and we're open to the idea of you know, using voice to be able to give us a gift. So we'll see if that evolves and if there's ultimately a confidence level that people have in using that technology. But, you know, we also want to try to make, you know, the whole notion of giving as frictionless as possible. So, you know, we're all about mobile giving and using our mobile devices to interact with us. You know, we've recently created a really cool site that I would urge all your listeners to go see called St. Jude Inspire, where we've really become like a media publishing platform, and we want people to understand some of the journeys of our patients and our supporters, and we're telling stories in really, really compelling ways through lots of different media. I don't know that there's another charity that's doing this. Mm-hmm. There's not many for-profits that are doing this, but this has been a tremendous success for us, and I actually think that it's going to lead to lots more great things, because people are going to our website. They're engaging with St. Jude Inspire, and they come back inspired, and, you know, it's really helped us from a donation perspective as well.
Yeah, and speaking about corporations, Rick, I mean, you look at your culture, you don't hesitate to take some of the best ideas from your corporate partners and then embed them at St. Jude's, do you?
Not in the least. You know, one of the blessings of my job is that I get to go around and talk to corporate America, and I am amazed at how open and generous many of our corporate executives are. And we will sit down and we will talk best practices, whether it's tech companies from Facebook and Google and Amazon to, you know, our diehard supporters like Best Buy and Target and Domino's. As I sit here today, we're blessed to have representatives of our Digital Innovation and Advisory Council here, and these are made up of primarily CIOs or similar folks in major brands around the United States right now, including PayPal and Hulu and Hilton. I mean, I can go on, and they're here to talk about innovation and to launch our Innovation Week with our employees. And, you know, I learn from these executives, and then we come back and we make some decisions. And I'll tell you, Denver, the single biggest thing I learned from these people is what not to do. Because you can't do everything. You can't chase shiny objects. And this is a great forum for me to be able to say, you know, I'm hearing a lot of things. What do you think we really ought to focus on that's going to move the needle so that we can take care of more and more kids? And they're just so generous with their time and their talents on top of their treasures. So we're very fortunate to have the support of corporate America, not just financially, but intellectually.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'll ask you one thing about culture, because I think it's both external, internal, and that would be transparency. And we can start with external. You share all your research, don't you?
We do share our research, and we also share our financials. So, so yeah, it's on both sides of the street. We share our research. You know, we protect our intellectual property, but we will share that intellectual property provided it's not being used for commercial purposes and things like that unless we enter into an agreed deal on that. But, yes, we share our research. A perfect example of that is the St. Jude Cloud, which we launched with Microsoft, where we took all of that pediatric cancer genomic data that you and I talked about earlier in this interview, and we took all those learnings and we uploaded it to the cloud, and that information on, you know, how to better diagnose kids with cancer and all the different strands of cancer, the subtypes of cancer, all of that's readily available in the St. Jude Cloud, and all you have to do is become a registered user, and it's available at no cost. That's an example of the kind of things that we do here at St. Jude.
You're doing a lot of things right, that's for sure. Let me close with this, Rick. You know, you hear this a lot in sports, but it's sometimes easier to get to the top than to stay at the top. And when it comes to reputation and research and respect, St. Jude's Children's Research Center has been at the top for many, many a year. What's the key for an organization to avoid complacency, but rather sustain excellence year after year after year?
Look, I think that we have to stay relevant. We have to continue to differentiate our brand, and we need to continue to morph our mission and the way we conduct business in a way that reflects the changing world that we're all operating in today, and actually getting ahead of all of those changes. So we're very future focused here.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether it's on the fundraising business side of the organization, we're looking out 5 and 10 and even 15 years from now. St. Jude is doing the exact same thing. This is why we believe that the next frontier is global. So this is what we do here. You know, we're constantly looking to improve ourselves and to differentiate ourselves, you know, in a really, really crowded space.
Never happy with the status quo. Well, Rick Shadyac, the president and CEO of ALSAC, the fundraising and awareness arm of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. For any listeners who might want to add their name to that list of 11 million donors or 1 million volunteers, or maybe know of a child who needs some help, where can they go to get some of that information?
They go right to our website at www.stjude.org.
And what was that other website you gave us before?
St. Jude Inspire. St. Jude, STJUDE/inspire, INSPIRE.
Okay. Thanks, Rick. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
It was my pleasure to be on your show. Thank you for having us, sir.
Thank you. I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to CharityNavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. CharityNavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
If you were to read a book about effective philanthropy, you would want it to be authored by someone who has examined, studied, and researched this topic from multiple perspectives for many a year. And that is exactly what my next guest has done. And as a result, has produced a clear and thoughtful approach how you can have greater impact with your own philanthropy. He is Phil Buchanan, the president and founding CEO of the Center for Effective Philanthropy. And his wonderful new book is Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. Good evening, Phil, and welcome back to the show.
Denver, thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into the book, tell listeners a little bit about the Center for Effective Philanthropy and what you do.
Sure. We work with donors, and historically it's been larger foundations we've worked with to help them to improve their effectiveness and impact. But in recent years, we've really begun to think about broadening our reach, trying to reach individual donors as well who might not be doing their giving through a foundation. So we do that through a research agenda we carry out, through assessment advisory services, and then we also have programming where we bring donors and foundation leaders together to talk about the unique challenge of effective philanthropy.
You know, so many authors, Phil, that I have on the show tell me that they have an urgency they feel about an issue, how it crystallizes in their mind, and that is what provides them the energy and the impetus to go ahead and write this book. Why did you write this book? And why do you believe it is so important right now?
Yeah, a couple reasons. I mean, one is over 17, almost 18 years, I've seen a lot of great examples of philanthropy that's really making a difference and supporting nonprofits that are doing incredible work. And I think it's an untold story, actually, in some ways, how crucial giving and the nonprofit sector is to what makes this country strong. And I've also witnessed donors make the same mistakes, predictable mistakes. And my hope is that the book helps people avoid some of the common pitfalls by educating them a bit about what is distinctly different about giving. So it's really that motivated me to try to figure out what are the lessons we've learned over all those years and put them together in a way that really speaks to people, tells us stories of donors who got it right, donors who got it wrong, of nonprofit leaders, and so on.
Yeah, let me pick up on what you just said there, and that has to do with the context of philanthropy in American society. Share with us a little bit about that, not only the present day, but historically as well.
Yeah. I mean, historically, giving and Of course, the freedom of association has been a part of this country from the very beginning. The settlers came seeking religious freedoms. There has always been an emphasis on organizing to get things done, citizens doing that. Obviously, in 1917, the tax code codified an encouragement to give through the charitable deduction. And the level of giving in this country has been the envy of the world. And it is sometimes described as stuck at a couple of percent of GDP. I think another way to look at it is that it has kept pace with GDP growth, and that's a real achievement. And so we have a strong and vibrant civil society. We have a nonprofit sector that includes everything from Harvard to the homeless shelter, and we have arts and culture organizations. We have endowed museums, everything in between. And most of our lives as American citizens have been touched by nonprofits in ways that we know, in ways that we don't know, and everything in between, and probably, more altogether than most of us realize. So I think that it's a really important part of this country. It's also much underappreciated, in my view.
Yeah. And the breadth of the sector really does boggle the mind.
Yeah,
it truly does. Warren Buffett, among others, has said it's an awful lot harder to give money away, wisely, of course, than it was to make it in the first place.
Yeah.
Why is it so challenging to do this? And what are some of those common pitfalls that you alluded to a moment ago?
Well, I think one, which Warren Buffett, you know, he didn't fall into this trap, is to think that giving is like investing. And it isn't. And the biggest reason it isn't, there's a whole bunch, but the biggest reason it isn't is because you can't measure performance easily in your giving in the way that you can in your investing. So you can finally compare investments or companies on common measures, even if they're working in very different industries. Not so in the world of giving. So even if you could understand the relationship, the sort of causal connection, which you usually can't, between what you gave to and what happened, it's very challenging to compare performance in one area to another. There's not a common impact unit by which you can gauge the results of your giving to arts and culture versus my giving to climate or the environment. So I think it's been a damaging trend, and you and I have talked about this many times over the last couple of decades, to want to analogize everything about giving to investing and everything about the nonprofit sector to business. They're really different animals.
Yeah, but the language overlaps a lot. We use those analogies. We use those metaphors all the time. And you really think it does a disservice and clouds the issue as opposed to clarifying it.
I do. Yeah, I do. And I think that, I tell this story in the book of sitting in a second year elective class as an MBA student and a sort of self-styled venture philanthropist was a guest speaker. And she was the sort of one of the poster children of the Harvard Business School social enterprise world. And she came in to tell everyone that the nonprofit sector was broken, that nonprofits were badly run, in need of aggressive investors to hold them to account. And she was there to do just that.
Lucky you.
And she had a whole new approach. It's like utter malarkey, really. I mean, in fact, and one of the things that I've done in writing the book is spent a lot of time with nonprofit leaders who I think are unsung American heroes whose job is actually vastly more complicated and difficult than it would be if they were CEO or of an equivalent size business. They have to do so much more. And so I just think it's important, if you're going to be a wise giver, to actually understand that, how hard these jobs are. And I can share all kinds of stories about that, and I try to do that in the book, and not to say, well, actually, it's what we really need is nonprofits to act more like business, whatever that even means. Like, what does that mean? The dry cleaner, Google, Volkswagen? It doesn't even really make sense. to say that. I think what people mean is they want organizations to be effective.
Yeah.
But then let's talk about that.
Yeah, I've had probably over a dozen nonprofit leaders who've been on the show who were former CEOs of corporations.
Yep.
And one of them said the job was equally difficult, and every other one said the nonprofit was 10 times more difficult than it was running their company.
Exactly.
Well, one of the places where these great sages from the business world came in and were going to fix our sector was in education.
Yeah.
They were going to apply some business principles to education. That may be the poster child of,
right.
of how that's all gone. Give us an idea of how some of that has worked or, let's say, not worked.
Yeah. I think there's this tendency to assume that there's going to be a quick fix, that you know we can disrupt education just as easily as Uber disrupted the taxi mm-hmm. you know industry if we just create the right app. You know, so you look at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has done much good work on global health in particular. But you look at the work in education, and it's been characterized by this, I think, hope, really a fantasy, that they will find the one thing. So first it was small high schools. Let's break large high schools into small high schools. We'll get better results. Doesn't seem to be working, although actually some argue that it was and they moved away too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the truth is, they moved away and they said, okay, next thing is teachers. It's all about effective teachers. We're going to focus on that. It's going to be about teacher evaluation, you know, perhaps linking teacher pay to performance was certainly something a number of education funders were interested in. Okay, nope, that wasn't it. Okay, it's about Common Core.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
a lot of eureka moments, eh?
Yeah, and time and time again, because these problems defy, in general, there are exceptions, but defy sort of single solutions, magic bullets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they're interdependent, and cause and effect is hard to predict here, and so it's really challenging. And education, as you say, Denver, is probably the area in which we've seen the most repeated and spectacular failures on the part of donors and big donors. In particular.
Yeah, and of course, we have it right here in this area with Mark Zuckerberg and the city of Newark
right.
and that $100 million investment. And I think it's somewhat healthy to see that both in his case and in Gates' case, they admitted that these things did not work out and that they were pretty much failures. And that at least is a healthy sign.
Agreed. And I think the lesson from Newark is, and I think this applies to some of the other education efforts as well, is in part that you cannot impose solutions
right.
top down. That, as a colleague of mine has said, you know, nobody wants to be told that someone else is the expert on their life,
mm-hmm.
right? So everybody agreed in Newark that the schools were broken and that they needed to be fixed. But the folks in neighborhoods, the families, the kids, the parents who would be affected by the changes were not engaged sufficiently, and yet they have the real expertise and knowledge. So I think one of the really good trends of recent years is we are seeing, I think, a bit more heightened awareness of the need to engage folks on the front lines, the folks whose lives you're trying to improve, in the conversation about what strategies will be most effective.
Yeah, invariably, the people who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution.
Exactly.
And that's always been the case. Let me talk about something which is a bane of, I think, each of our existence, and that has to do with the overhead question.
Yeah.
And that narrative still prevails. That
yeah.
when I make a contribution, I am going to be totally focused on how much of that is going to program
yeah.
and how much of that is going to administration and fundraising. And that is going to be a key, if not the key determinant, as to whether I'm going to support an organization. What is wrong with that question, and why does that narrative still carry the day in so many different places?
Well, I think the narrative, to answer the last part first, carries the day because of what I already alluded to, which is the desire for the analog to ROI or profit. So what is the standardized, quantifiable, comparative metric that cuts across program areas? Well, overhead is one.
And it's simple.
And it's simple, except that it's not,
of
because
course.
The definitions are all over the map.
You can make up any calculation you want to get to your overhead. I
yeah,
agree.
Exactly. And I think, look, I think there are obviously like extreme cases where you have folks spending tremendous amounts on for-profit fundraisers. And, you know, these are abuses, really, right, which nonprofits have been set up there that are little more than shells for for-profit fundraisers who and you have a very high percentage that's just going in their pockets. Obviously, that shouldn't happen. We need to call it out. But in a ethically run, you know, well-functioning nonprofit organization, their key question is, what are they achieving relative to their goals and relative to their overall budget? And then I think we need to have some faith in folks to allocate that budget as they see fit. And things that sometimes get deemed overhead are, in fact, necessary to delivering the results. Right. so you look at an organization, you know, feeding the hungry, and you say, well, we only want to pay for the food, mm-hmm. not the rent on the space where the volunteers come and provide the food. You know, that doesn't make any sense.
So
I think, but I think because the performance measurement challenge is so significant and people find it frustrating and they want something, they gravitate toward what's available. And as a result, they don't always make the best decisions.
Yeah, I had a very interesting guest on the show a while back by the name of Carolyn Fine. She's
yeah.
from the UK.
Yeah, she's terrific.
Yeah, she really is, and very funny woman. And she leads an organization called Giving Evidence.
Yeah.
And she's a physicist who came over to this sector. And what she did is she went to the GiveWell blog where they rate the best organizations. And in through her analysis, she found that those that they rated most highly had the highest overhead.
Right.
So
right.
it just goes to show you that it can be totally misleading. So if we're not going to do that, how does a donor then begin to analyze the performance and measure the impact of that organization so they can make an intelligent decision on their own contribution?
Yeah. Well, and here's where it's more work than anybody wants it to be. But but really what I think you want to look for is answers to three pretty simple questions. What are they doing? In other words, like, what are their goals?
Mm-hmm.
How are they doing it? Like, what is their approach or their strategies? And then what information do they have about how it's going? So what are the metrics that they use to gauge their success? So to give an example, an organization that I write about in the book that I also, you know, after learning about them, have started personally, you know, supporting, is called UTEC. And they're in Lowell, Lawrence, and Haverhill in outside Boston. And they focus on working with the very the most violent young people who are involved in gang life.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to recruit them out of gang life, get them employed at one of their social enterprises, help them turn their lives around. And, you know, talk about a tough job, right? And, you know, so what do they monitor? They monitor recidivism. You know, what percentage of their young people who they work with end up falling back into a life of crime? They compare that to state averages and they see how they're doing. So that's how they know. And that's what you want to look at. What are they doing? How are they doing it? How do they know if they're making progress?
You know, I've been in this sector my entire life, and there always seems to be a flavor of the month.
Yes.
Around discussions of the sector. And currently, it would be the evils of big philanthropy.
Yeah.
And how it is undermining democracy.
Yeah.
And perhaps the leading voice there would be Anand Girihardos, who has written a book which has captured a lot of attention called Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of...
What was it? Changing the World.
Yeah. The author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. And he believes that big donors are merely perpetuating a system that led to their extraordinary wealth in the first place. You tend to look at these matters in a very balanced way. Give us your critique on that.
Okay, I'll try to live up to that and say I agree with Anand that there is, you know, that there are, I should say, examples of donors who have used their philanthropy to distract, for example, from their unethical business practices.
Like
and
the Sacklers.
Exactly. And Anand speaks all the time about mm-hmm. that example. And I also think that there has been too much of a kind of happy talk in which it's actually business that's going to solve all our problems, right? Without recognizing that, you know, if business could solve all our problems, they'd probably be solved, right? That there are some challenges that markets and government haven't been able to work out, and that's often where philanthropy comes in. So those are areas in which I agree.
Okay.
But I think Anand paints with a absurdly broad brush, that it is a overly generalized caricature that denies much of the good that givers do, including ultra-wealthy givers who are motivated by a genuine and real desire to have a positive impact on the world, not to preserve the status quo or to buttress their own reputation. So I think it's unfortunate and unfair to paint with that broad a brush. And I worry about it from the standpoint both of what signals it sends about what we want to encourage. I mean, it's interesting to note that recently, not too, you know, in not too distant times, there was a lot of critique of many of the very wealthiest for not giving enough.
Yeah.
Right?
Buying
and then come in the giving
Buying
pledge
houses.
And so on.
Yeah.
And now we're criticizing them for giving too much, right? So, and most of the donors, you know, and granted, it's not a representative sample, but the individual donors who we work with, right? They're trying really hard to get it right, and they don't always get it right. And we should call them out when they don't. We shouldn't bow down to anyone. But giving is good, and we should be encouraging it. And I think Anand, and to a certain extent, Rob Reich at Stanford
right.
in his book, are conflating a critique of our current approach to taxation and the belief that the wealthy should be taxed at a higher rate, that, for example, the capital gains should not be taxed at a lower rate than income. A lot of things that I generally agree with. And they're sort of lumping that together with a critique of philanthropy. And ultimately, it's our elected representatives in Congress that have to address the first challenge. Meantime, we have folks who have resources, and they have choices about what to do with those resources, and I would like them to try to give back, and I would like to help them to try to do it effectively.
See, that was very balanced.
I try.
On the other hand, I think the number of Americans contributing to charity has been declining
right.
for a number of years. Now, some of that may have been the recent tax law, but it's been going on longer than that. What do you make of that, and are you concerned about that trend?
Concerned? I don't think we actually know the effect of the recent tax law change yet. You know, but I think the data, you know, good reliable data is hard to find on this. But there is data that suggests that there's been a decline in the percentage of households giving. And there's some data that suggests, you know, that middle class families in particular may be giving at lower rates. I think that's hugely concerning. And I think, you know, one of the things, not to bring it back to the book, but that I'm trying to do in the book is inspire people to give by reminding them of the tremendous progress that giving has helped contribute to. So I think some of the decline may be just related to stagnating wages, you know, for many in the middle class. But I wonder if some of it is also related to the fact that we have not sufficiently held up nonprofits, what they can do, what they have done, and that we've had this narrative over the last couple of decades in which we have this sort of business knows best crew saying, hey, philanthropy folks and nonprofit folks, you got it all wrong. Business has all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got Anand and others saying, no, you've got it all wrong. Government's got all the answers. Well, my view is actually no sector's got all the answers. That each of the three sectors has a distinct role to play, that they each need each other to be their best, that none are their best today, and that that's a better lens for how we think about what will make this country be what we want it to be.
Yeah, and I think also a better lens for all this would be if the media every once in a while reported a good story.
Absolutely.
Because so much we hear about the nonprofit sector is the latest scandal.
Absolutely.
That's what's going to make the news.
Right.
Not the things that are really positive. And to the extent that they do it, they're usually puppy dog stories that make
right.
you feel good. But they're
right.
not transformative change stories,
right.
which they should be reporting. Well, you do talk in the book about philanthropy that is done right. So let's talk a little bit about that. And a good example would be the Wilberforce Foundation
yeah.
and the donor behind that. So tell us that story.
Oh, sure. So Rose Letwin was at a Microsoft early employee. She cared a lot, you know, I think as a young girl and certainly as an adult about about animals and about the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And she, I think, and this is true of so many donors. She never expected, I don't think, to have the resources that she had, and then asked herself, well, what am I going to do? And really has focused on protection of habitats for wildlife and conservation in the Pacific Northwest, in the U.S. and Canada. And they've been hugely successful in helping to preserve land and the natural beauty in that part of the country. And they have done that by supporting usually small and locally based organizations that are fighting to protect, whether it be forests or whatever, and by strengthening those organizations, linking them up in a network and providing them the support they need to do their work as best they can. So they're a great example to me, I think, of an organization that is very focused on what they're focused on. They know what they're trying to do. And then they also are very clear about the fact that it is the nonprofits, it is the grantees who are at the center, who are really doing the work, and that their job is to have a relationship with those organizations that strengthens those organizations to do their work better. And I think they've done a really good job.
You spend a lot of time on relationships, don't you?
Yes.
To speak a little bit about that, because they are so important in terms of doing things successfully. What's your thinking on that?
Well, I mean, I think here again, we see the business analogies aren't helpful. So people sometimes say, well, like big donors or foundations will say, our grantees are like customers. Mm. Well, no, they're nothing like customers, because the money's flowing in the opposite direction and the power dynamics are completely different. If you and I go out to lunch, you know, someday and we don't like our meal and the service is terrible, we can never go back there again if we want to. We can trash the place online. No fear. You know, if we have a bad If we're running a nonprofit, though, and we have a bad interaction with a big donor, you know, we're not going to say much to anyone about it. And so the dynamics are completely different. And why does that matter? It matters because donors can't do their work effectively if they don't understand what's going on the ground. And the only way they're going to understand what's going on the ground is strong, trusting relationships with their grantees. That's how they're going to hear, actually, the strategy we're trying isn't working, rather than, oh, yes, it's working wonderfully. Because you know, just to underline the point, folks are predisposed to tell big donors what they think those donors want to hear.
Yeah.
And so that lack of good, candid data and information can get in the way of refinements in strategy that need to occur. And we see this time and time again. So I just think relationships are absolutely crucial to being an effective donor.
Yeah, and it also gets back to this overhead issue, because I know so many who will tell the foundation an overhead, which the foundation knows is not the real overhead.
Right.
But they're trying to get the grant.
It's
so
a dance
when
of
you
deceit.
Start, it's a dance. It's a dishonest discussion.
Right.
And if it starts that way, it stays that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like the sector, maybe this should be your next book, we need a whole new taxonomy to really describe these things, because we're relying on so many. Even the word nonprofit in itself is describing what we're not.
Right.
So perhaps language will be critical in perhaps increasing that understanding. Let me close with this, Phil. In the process of writing this book, was there something that perhaps you had always sort of thought about in the back of your mind but never really fully appreciated in terms of its centrality and importance to the whole philanthropic sector?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that I did in writing the book is try to get beyond all of the research we've done on nonprofits and their perspectives on donors and what would be helpful to them through all the survey work that we do, all of the qualitative comments that we read, and actually go out and spend time, you know, to spend a day or a half day in different organizations. And this is something I'm continuing to do, is to be inspired by the sort of heroism of the staff and volunteers in community-based organizations working on the front lines of the toughest challenges. So we're, you know, spent time at a community-based health organization in Houston, Texas, met the executive director and saw what they're doing to try to help the most desperately poor there, spent time with a volunteer, a retired lawyer who just turned 80, you know, who comes in and gives coordinates the vision testing that they have outside folks come in and do for poor people who might not otherwise have access to it. The sense of community among and sort of passion for the mission among the staff and the volunteers, and the degree to which that purpose is motivating them. And I feel like in our society, we read a lot about corporate CEOs and business titans and the Kardashians and whoever else. And I would love to see us reading about folks like this, the staff and the volunteers who are doing this tremendously important work that nobody else is doing and that communities so desperately need.
Well, if it's going to lift the psyche and make this country feel more positive, those stories do definitely need to be told. Well, Phil Buchanan, the president and founding CEO of the Center for Effective Philanthropy, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. The book is Giving Done Right, Effective Philanthropy and Making Every Dollar Count. It truly provides the grounding and clarity that every donor needs to have, and you should definitely pick it up. Thanks so much, Phil, for being on the show.
Denver, thank you so much for having me.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Deborah Borda, the president and CEO of the New York Philharmonic. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and do return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.